box far out of reach, he had run for the closest building, a small wood-framed house that the tax office used for storage. Among the boxes of meaningless paperwork, he was joined over the next 2 hours by the 7 survivors with whom he now stood. For the rest of the night, they had remained there, trying not to attract attention to themselves, waiting for an end that never came. Since daybreak, more survivors had emerged, but not very many. The sight of so many bodies was jarring, sickening. The vultures had begun to alight, pecking at the meat. It was nothing for the children to see. During the night, Sarah had counted heads. The shelter contained 654 souls, mostly women and children. Sarah descended the ladder to help Jenny organize their removal. "What about the other hard boxes?" Peter asked. Chase's face was grim. "They got in through the floors."
"Olivia?"
Chase shook his head. "I'm sorry, Ford." He shook his head faintly. None of this was registering completely yet.
"What about the tubes?"
"Flooded. I don't know how they did it, but they did."
Peter's stomach dropped. A wave of cold dizziness passed through him. "Peter?" Chase was gripping his arm. Suddenly, he was the strong one.
"No survivors?" Peter asked.
Chase shook his head.
"There's something else you need to see."
It was Apgar. The man was alive, though barely. He lay on the ground beside an overturned Humvee. His legs were crushed beneath the frame, though that was not the worst of it. On his left hand, which lay across his chest, was a semicircular imprint of teeth. He was still in the shade, but the sun would soon find him. Peter knelt beside him.
"Gunner, can you hear me?"
The man's awareness seemed divided. Then, with a faint start, his eyes alighted on Peter's face.
"Peter.
Hello."
His voice was bland, lacking emotion, except, perhaps, for a touch of mild surprise.
"Just lie still."
"Oh, I'm not going anywhere."
His legs had been crushed to a pulp, yet he seemed to be experiencing no pain at all. He lifted his wounded hand with a vague gesture.
"Can you believe this shit?
Does anybody have any water?"
Caleb produced a canteen. Just an inch or two sloshed in the bottom. Peter cupped the man's neck to lift his head and held the spout to his lips. Peter wondered why Apgar had not yet turned. Of course, there was a range. It varied person to person. A few weak sips, water dribbling from the corners of his mouth, and Apgar leaned back.
"It's true, what they say. You can feel it inside you."
He took a long, shuddering breath.
"How many survivors?"
Peter shook his head.
"Not many."
"Don't blame yourself."
"Gunner,
take this as my last piece of official advice. You've done all you could. It's time to get these people out of here."
The general licked his lips and lifted the bloody hand again.
"But let's not let this go on too long. I don't want people to see me like this."
Peter turned his face and scanned the group. Chase, Hollis, Caleb, a few of the soldiers. All were staring. He felt benumbed. None of it seemed real yet.
"Somebody give me something."
Hollis produced a knife. Peter accepted its cold weight into his hand. For a moment he doubted he could find the strength to do what was required of him. He crouched beside Apgar again, holding the blade a little behind himself to keep it from view.
"It's been an honor to serve under you, Mr. President."
Through a throat thickened with tears, Peter raised his voice, speaking words no one had said in over 20 years.
"This man is a soldier of the expeditionary. It is time for him to take the trip. All hail General Gunner Apgar. Hip, hip, hooray! Hip, hip, hooray! Hip, hip, hooray!
Apgar took a long breath and let it out slowly. His face became peaceful.
Thank you, Peter. I'm ready now.
Peter tightened his grip on the knife. There were two more. Peter was looking at Apgar's body. The man had died quickly, almost inaudibly. A grunt as the knife went in, his eyes opening wide, death easing into them.
Somebody get me a blanket.
No one spoke.
God damn it, what's the matter with you people? You!
He jabbed a finger at one of the soldiers.
What's your name, Private?
The man seemed a little dazed.
Sir?
What?
You don't know your own name? Are you that stupid?
He swallowed nervously.
It's Verone, sir.
Organize a burial detail. I want everyone gathered at the parade ground in 30. Full military honors, do you read me? He glanced at the others.
Is there a problem, soldier?
Dad.
Caleb gripped him by an arm and made his father look at him.
I know this is painful. We all understand how you felt about him. I'll get a blanket, all right?
The tears had begun to flow. His jaw trembled with confined fury.
We're not just leaving him here for the birds, goddammit.
There are a lot of bodies out here. We really don't have time. Peter shook him off.
This man was a hero. He's the reason any of us are still alive.
Caleb spoke in measured tones.
I know that, Dad. Everyone does. But the general was right. We really have to think about what comes next.
I'll tell you what comes next. We bury this man.
Mr. President.
Peter turned. Jock. Someone had wrapped his ankle and found him a pair of crutches. He was sweating and a little out of breath.
What the hell is it now?
The man seemed uncertain.
For God's sake, just say it.
It looks like somebody's alive outside.
The gate was gone. One of the doors had been knocked askew and was hanging from a single hinge. The other lay on the ground 100 feet inside the wall. As they moved through the opening, Peter's first impossible impression was that it had snowed in the night. A fine, pale dust coated every surface. A moment passed before he grasped the meaning. Carter's army lay dead. Their bones, now in sunlight, had begun their dissolution. Amy was sitting near the base of the wall, arms wrapping her knees, gazing across the field. Covered in ash, she looked like a ghost, a specter from a children's story. A few feet beyond her, beside Soldier's body, lay Alicia. The horse's throat was torn open, among other things. Flies were buzzing around him, dipping in and out of his wounds. Peter strode forward with gathering speed. Amy turned her face toward him.
He didn't kill us, she said.
She spoke as if in a daze.
Why didn't he kill us?
Her presence barely registered in Peter's mind. It was Alicia he wanted.
You knew!
He barreled past Amy, seized Alicia by the arm, and rolled her face up.
You fucking knew all along!
Amy cried,
Peter, stop!
He dropped to his knees and straddled Alicia's waist. His fingers wrapped her throat. His eyes and mind filled with the loathsome sight of her.
He was my friend!
More voices, not just Amy's, were yelling at him. But this was a matter of no importance. They might just as well have been calling to him from the moon. Alicia was making a gurgling sound. Her lips were paling to a bluish color. She was squinting into the morning light. Through these narrow slits, their gazes met. In her eyes, Peter saw not fear, but fatalistic acceptance.
Go ahead,
her eyes said. We've done everything else together. Why not this? Beneath the pads of his thumbs, He felt the stringy gristle of her trachea. He shifted them downward, positioning them in the spoon-like depression at the base of her throat. Hands had grabbed him. Some were tugging at his shoulders, others attempting to pry his fingers from her neck.
"He was my friend, and you killed him. You killed all of them."
One hard push to crush her larynx, and that would be the end of her.
"Say it, you traitor! Say you knew!"
A tremendous force yanked him away. He crashed onto his back in the dust.
"Hollis, take a breath, Peter."
The man had positioned himself between Peter and Alicia, who had begun to cough. Amy was kneeling beside her, cradling her head.
"We all heard her," Hollis said. "She was trying to warn us."
Peter's face was burning. His hands, clenched into fists, shook with adrenaline.
"She lied to us."
"I understand your anger. We all do. But she didn't know."
Peter's awareness expanded. The others were watching him in mute incomprehension. Caleb, Chase, Jock leaning on his crutches, the old man, who was for some reason still carrying his bucket.
"Now, do I have your agreement to leave her be?"
"Yes or no?"
Hollis said. Peter swallowed. The fog of fury had begun to dissipate. Another moment, and he nodded.
"All right, then," said Hollis.
He extended a hand and pulled Peter to his feet. Alicia's coughing had eased somewhat. Amy looked up.
"Caleb, run and get Sarah."
Amy waited by Alicia until Sarah arrived. At the sight of Alicia, she startled. "You're kidding me." Her voice was dispassionate, lacking all pity.
"Please, Sarah,"
said Amy. There were tears in her eyes.
"You think I'm helping her?"
Sarah scanned the others.
"She can go to hell."
Hollis took her by the shoulders to make her look at him.
"She's not our enemy, Sarah. Please believe me. And we're going to need her."
"What for?"
"To help us get out of here. Not just you and me. Pim, Theo, the girls."
A moment passed. Sarah sighed and broke away. She crouched beside Alicia, passing her eyes quickly over her without expression, then looked up.
"I'm not doing this with an audience. Amy, you stay. The rest of you, a little space, please."
The group backed away. Caleb took Peter aside.
"Dad? Okay?"
He wasn't sure what to say. His anger had faded, but not his doubt. He glanced past his son's shoulder. Sarah was moving her hands over Alicia's chest and stomach, pressing with her fingertips.
"Yeah. Everybody understands."
Caleb said nothing more. Neither did anyone else. A few more minutes went by before Sarah rose and went to them.
"She's broken up pretty badly."
Her tone was indifferent. She was doing a job, that was all.
"I can't really tell the full extent. And in her case, things will probably happen differently. A couple of the gunshot wounds have closed up already, but I don't know what's happening inside. She's got a broken back and about 6 other fractures I can detect."
"Will she live?" Amy asked. "If she were anyone else, she'd be dead already. I can sew her up and set her leg. She needs to be immobilized. As for the rest," she shrugged without feeling.
"Your guess is as good as mine."
Caleb and Chase returned with a stretcher. They carried Alicia inside. All the survivors had been brought out of the shelter and had gathered in the staging area. Jenny and Hannah were moving through the group with buckets of water and ladles. Here and there a person was sobbing. Others were talking quietly, or just gazing into space.
"So what now?" Chase asked.
Peter felt unattached to everything, almost floating. Particles of ash, bitter-smelling, drifted down. The fires had begun to spread. Leaping from building to building, they would sweep down to the river, consuming everything in their path. Other parts of the city, spared from the flames, would take longer. Years. Decades. Rain, wind, the devouring teeth of time. All would do their work. Peter could see it in his mind. Kerrville would become one more ruin in a world of them. He was suddenly crushed by the simplicity of it all. The city had fallen. The city was gone. He felt it keenly, the stab of defeat. "Caleb? Here, Dad." Peter turned. His son was waiting. Everyone was. "We need vehicles. Buses, trucks, whatever you can find. Fuel, too. Hollis, you go with him. Ford, what do we have for power?" "Everything's out." "The barracks have a backup generator. See if we can get it running. We need to get a message to Michael. Tell him we're coming. Sarah, you'll be in charge here. People will need food and water, enough for the day. But everybody needs to stay put. No wandering off, no looking for family or retrieving belongings."
"What about a search party?"
Amy asked. "There could still be people out there." "Take 2 men and a vehicle. Start on the other side of the river and work your way back. Stay clear of shaded areas and keep out of the buildings."
"I'd like to help," Jock said.
"Fine. Do your best, but be quick about it. You've got 1 hour. No passengers unless they're injured. Anyone who can walk can make it here on their own."
"What if we find more infected who haven't turned yet?" Caleb asked.
"That's up to them. Make the offer. If they don't take it, leave them where they are. It won't make any difference." He paused. "Is everyone clear?"
Nods and murmurs passed around the group.
"Then that's it," Peter said. "We're done here. 60 minutes, people. And we're gone."
74. They were 764 souls. They were dirty, exhausted, terrified, confused. They rode in 6 buses, 3 to a seat, 4 5-tons crammed with people, 8 smaller trucks, both military and civilian, their cargo beds full of supplies, water, food, fuel. They had only a few weapons and barely any ammunition. Among their numbers, they counted 532 children under the age of 13, 309 of these below the age of 6. They included 122 mothers of children 3 and younger, including 19 women who were still nursing infants. Of the remaining 110, there were 68 men and 42 women of various ages and backgrounds. 32 were, or had been, soldiers. 9 were over the age of 60. The oldest, a widow who had sat in her house through the night, muttering to herself that all the noise outside was just a bunch of goddamn nonsense, was 82. They included mechanics, electricians, nurses, weavers, shopkeepers, bootleggers, farmers, farriers, a gunsmith, and a cobbler. One of the passengers was the drunken doctor, Brian Ilacqua. Too inebriated to comprehend the orders to relocate to the dam, he had found himself, as night had fallen, wondering where everyone had gone. He had passed the 24 hours since his return to Kerrville drinking himself into oblivion in the abandoned house that had once been his, a miracle he had managed to find it, and awakened to a silence and darkness that disturbed him. Departing his house in search of more liquor, he reached the square just as gunfire erupted along the wall. He was profoundly disoriented and still quite drunk. Dimly, he wondered, why were people shooting? He decided to head for the hospital. It was a place he knew, a touchstone. Also, maybe someone could tell him what in the hell was going on. As he made his way there, his apprehension mounted. The gunfire had continued, and he was hearing certain other sounds as well. Vehicles racing, cries of distress.
As the hospital came into sight, a shout went up, followed by a barrage of shooting. Ilakwa hit the dirt. He had no idea what to make of any of this. It seemed entirely unconnected to him. Also, he wondered, with sudden concern, what had become of his wife. It was true that she despised him, yet he was accustomed to her presence. Why was she not here? These questions were shoved aside by the sound and shock of a tremendous impact. Ilakwa peeled his face off the ground. A truck had crashed into the front of the building. Not just into, it had rammed straight through the wall. He got to his feet and stumbled toward it. Perhaps someone was injured, he thought. Perhaps they needed help.
Get in, a man yelled from the cab. Everybody in the truck!
Ilakwa wobbled his way up the steps and beheld a scene of such disorder that his addled brain could not compute it. The room was full of screaming women and children. Soldiers were shoving and tossing them into the cargo bed while simultaneously shooting over their heads in the direction of the stairwell. Ilakwa was caught in the crush. From the chaos, his mind distilled the image of a familiar face. Was that Sarah Wilson? He had a sense that he'd seen her rather recently, though he could not pull the memory into shape. Either way, getting into the truck seemed like a good idea. He fought his way through the melee. Children were scrambling all around and underfoot. The driver of the vehicle was racing the engine. By this time, Ilakwa had reached the tailgate. The truck was packed with people, barely any room at all. Also, there was the problem of getting one foot onto the bumper to hoist himself into the cargo compartment, an act requiring a degree of physical coordination he didn't think he could muster.
Help me, he moaned.
A hand, heaven sent, reached down. Up and into the truck he went, tumbling over bodies as the vehicle shot forward. A syncopation of bone-jarring bangs followed as the truck sailed out of the building and down the steps. Through the fog of terror and confusion, Brian Ilakwa experienced a revelation. His life had been unworthy. It might not have begun that way. He'd meant to be a good and decent man. But over the years he had strayed far from the path. If I get out of this, he thought, I won't ever touch a drink again. Which was how, 16 hours later, Brian Ilakwa came to find himself on a school bus of 87 women and children, deep in the physical and existential sorrows of acute alcohol withdrawal. It was still early morning, the light soft with a golden color. He had, with many others, watched from the window as the city faded, then disappeared from sight. He wasn't completely sure where they were going. There was talk of a ship that would take them to safety, though he found this difficult to fathom. Why had he, of all people, a man who had squandered his life, the most worthless of worthless drunks, survived? Seated on the bench beside him was a little girl with strawberry blonde hair, tied in back with a ribbon. He supposed she was 4 or 5. She was wearing a loose dress of thick woven fiber. Her feet were dirty and bare, covered with numerous scratches and scabs. At her waist, she clutched a ratty stuffed toy. Some kind of animal. A bear, or maybe a dog. She had yet to acknowledge him in any manner, her eyes staring forward.
Where are your parents, honey?
Ilakwa asked.
Why are you alone?
Because they're dead. The little girl stated. She did not look at him as she spoke. They're all dead. And with that, Brian Ilakwa dropped his face to his hands, his body shaking with tears. At the wheel of the first bus, Caleb was watching the clock. The hour was approaching noon. They had been on the road a little more than 4 hours. Pim and Theo sat behind him with the girls. He was down to half a tank. They planned to stop in Rosenberg, where a tanker from the Isthmus would meet them to refuel. The bus was quiet. No one was talking. Lulled by the rocking of the chassis, most of the children had fallen asleep. They had passed through the last of the outer townships when the radio crackled. "Pull over, everyone. Looks like we've lost one." Caleb brought the bus to a halt and stepped down as his father, Chase, and Amy emerged from the lead Humvee. One of the buses, the fourth in line, was parked with its hood open. Steam and liquid were pouring from its radiator. Hollis was standing on the bumper, slapping at the engine with a rag. "I think it's the water pump."
"Can you do anything about it?" Caleb's father said. "It'd have to be fast."
Hollis jumped down. "No chance. These old things aren't built for this. I'm surprised it's taken this long for one to conk out."
"As long as we're stopped," Sarah suggested, "probably the children need to go."
"Go where?"
"To the bathroom, Peter."
Caleb's father sighed impatiently. Any minute of delay was a minute they'd be driving in darkness at the other end.
"Just watch for snakes. That's all we need right now."
The children filed off and were led into the weeds, girls on one side of the buses, boys on the other. By the time the convoy was ready to move again, they had been stopped for 20 minutes. A hot Texas wind was blowing. It was 01:30 hours. The sun poised above them like the head of a hammer in the sky. The patch was complete, the dock ready to fill. Michael, Lore, and Rand, in one of 6 pump houses along the weir, were preparing to open the vents to the sea. Greer was gone, headed with Patch to Rosenberg in the last tanker truck.
"Shouldn't we say something?" Lore asked Michael.
"How about, please open, you bastard?"
The wheel had not been turned in 17 years.
"That'll have to do," said Lore.
Michael wedged a pry bar between the spokes. Lore was holding a mallet. Michael and Rand gripped the bar and leaned in.
"Hit it now."
Lore, positioned to the side, swung the mallet. It glanced off the top of the rim.
"For God's sake!"
Michael's jaws were clenched, his face reddened with effort.
"Hit the bastard!"
Blow after blow. Still the wheel refused to turn.
"This isn't great," Rand said.
"Let me try," said Lore.
"How's that going to help?"
Then when Lore just stared at him, he stepped aside.
"Suit yourself."
Lore left the pry bar where it was, gripping the wheel instead.
"You've got no leverage," Rand said. "That'll never work."
Lore ignored him. She planted her feet wide. The muscles in her arms tightened, thick ropes stretched over bone.
"This is pointless," Michael said. "We have to think of something else."
Then, miraculously, the wheel began to turn. An inch, then 2. They all heard it. Water had begun to move. A fine spray shot through the vent on the floor of the dock. With a jolt, the wheel released. Below them, the seas began to pour in. Lore backed away, flexing her fingers.
"We must have loosened it," Rand said lamely.
She gave them a droll smile. The time was fast approaching. His army was gone. Carter had felt the dopies leaving him, a scream of terror and a blast of pain, and then the letting go. Their souls had passed through him like wind, a whirl of memories, waning, then gone. He did the last of his chores for the day with a solemn feeling. A deck of low clouds moved over the sky as he rolled his mower to the shed, padlocked the door, and turned to face the yard so that he might survey his handiwork. The crisp lawn, every blade just so, the tailored edges along the walkways with their bit of monkey grass to mark them, the trees all limbed up and the flowers, banks of them, like a carpet of color beneath the hedges. That morning, a dwarf Japanese cut-leaf maple had appeared by the gate. Mrs. Wood had always wanted one. Carter had rolled it in its plastic pot to the corner of the yard and set it in the ground. Cut-leaves had an elegant feel to them, like the hands of a beautiful woman.
It felt like an act of completion to plant it there. A final gift to the yard he'd tended for so long. He wiped his brow. The sprinklers came on, scattering a fine mist over the lawn. Inside the house, the little girls were laughing. Carter wished he could see them, talk to them. He imagined himself sitting on the patio while watching them play in the yard, tossing a ball or chasing each other. Little girls needed time in the sunshine. He hoped he didn't stink too bad. He sniffed his armpits and supposed he'd pass all right. At the kitchen window, he inspected his reflection. It was a long time since he'd bothered to do that. He supposed he looked like he always had, which wasn't really one thing or the other, just a face like most people's. For the first time in over a century, Carter opened the gate and stepped through. The air wasn't any different here. He wondered why he'd thought it might be. The busy city made a whooshing sound in the background, but the street was otherwise quiet, all the big houses staring back at him with no particular interest. He walked to the end of the drive to wait, fanning himself with his hat. It was the hour when everything changes. The birds, the insects, the worms in the grass, all know this. Cicadas were buzzing in the trees. 75. 1700. Greer and Patch had been waiting in the tanker truck for 2 hours. Patch was reading a magazine. Reading, or perhaps just looking at it. It was called National Geographic Kids. The pages were brittle and popped out when he turned them. He nudged Greer on the shoulder and held it out to show him a picture. "Think it'll be like that?" A jungle scene. Fat green leaves, brightly colored birds, everything wreathed in vines. Greer was too preoccupied to look very closely. "I don't know. Maybe." Patch took it back. "I wonder if there's people out there." Greer used binoculars to scan the horizon to the north. "I doubt it. Because if there is, I hope they're friendly. Seems like a lot to go through if they're not." Another 15 minutes passed. "Maybe we should go look for them," Patch suggested. "Hang on. I think this is them." A cloud of dust had formed in the distance. Greer watched through the binoculars as the image of the convoy took shape. The two men climbed down from the cab as the first vehicle drew up. "What kept you?" Greer asked Peter. "We lost 2 buses, a busted radiator and a broken axle." All of the vehicles took diesel, except the smaller pickups, which carried their own extra fuel. Greer organized a team to pour the diesel off into jugs. They began moving down the line to refill the buses. The children were allowed off, but told not to wander far. "How long is this going to take?" Chase asked Greer. It took almost an hour. The shadows had begun to stretch. They had 50 more miles to go, but these would be the hardest. None of the buses would be able to travel more than 20 miles per hour over the rough terrain. The convoy began to move again. The dock had been filling for 7 hours. Everything was ready. Batteries charged, bilge pumps on, engines ready to fire. Chains had been fixed to hold the Bergensfjord in place. Michael was in the pilot house with Lore. The sea had risen a yard past the waterline, within a reasonable margin of error, but disturbing nonetheless. "I can't stand this," Lore said. She was pacing around the tiny space, all her energy suddenly having nowhere to go. Michael picked up the microphone from the panel. "Rand, what are you seeing down there?" He was moving through the corridors below decks, checking seams. "All good so far. No leaks. She seems tight." Higher and higher the water rose, wrapping the hull in its cold embrace. Still, the ship refused to budge. "Flyers, this is killing me," groaned Lore. That's not an expression I've ever heard you use, Michael said.
Well, I kind of see the sense of it now.
Michael held up a hand. He'd felt something. He willed all his senses to focus. The sensation came again, the tiniest shudder rippling through the hall. His eyes met Lore's. She'd detected it too. The great creature was coming to life. The deck shifted beneath them with a deep moan.
Here we go, Lore cried.
The Bergensfjord began to lift from her braces. At the end of the block, the Denali appeared, turning the corner with painstaking care. Carter stepped into the road and positioned himself in its path. He did not hold up his hand or in any way indicate his wish that it should stop. He stepped aside as the car came to a halt in front of him. With a hushed, mechanical purr, the driver's window drew down. Crisp air and a smell of leather flowed out onto his face.
Mr. Carter?
It's good to see you, Mrs. Wood. She was wearing her tennis clothes, the silver packages in back, the baby seat with its mobile of plush toys, the sunglasses perched on her head. All the same as the morning they'd met.
You're looking well, he said.
Her eyes narrowed on his face, as if she were attempting to read small print.
You stopped me.
Yes, ma'am.
I don't understand. Why did you do that?
Why don't you pull into the driveway? We can have us a talk.
She glanced around in confusion.
You go on now, he assured her.
Rather reluctantly, she turned the Denali into the driveway and shut off the engine. Carter stepped to the driver's side window again. The motor was making a quiet ticking sound. Hands locked on the steering wheel, Rachel stared straight out the windshield, as if afraid to look at him.
I don't think I'm supposed to be doing this, she said.
It's all right, Carter said.
Her voice sharpened with panic.
But it's not all right. It's not all right at all.
Carter opened her door.
Why don't you come and see the yard, Mrs. Wood? Kept it nice for you.
I'm supposed to drive the car. That's what I do. That's my job.
Just this morning planted one of those cut-leaf maples you like. You should see how pretty it is.
For a moment she was silent. Then,
a cut-leaf maple, you say?
Yes, ma'am.
She nodded pensively to herself.
I always thought it would be just the right thing for that corner. You know the one I mean?
Absolutely I do.
She turned to look at him. For a moment she studied his face, her blue eyes slightly squinted.
You're always thinking of me, aren't you, Mr. Carter? You always know just the thing to say. I don't think I've ever had a friend like you.
Oh, I expect you have. Oh, please. I have people, sure. Lots of people in Rachel Wood's life.
But never anyone who understands me the way you do.
She looked at him kindly.
But you and me, we're quite a pair, aren't we? I'd say we are, Mrs. Wood.
Now, if I've said it once, I've said it a thousand times. It's Rachel.
He nodded.
Anthony, then.
Her face opened, as if she'd discovered something.
Rachel and Anthony. We're like two characters in a movie.
He held out a hand.
Why don't you come on now, Rachel? It'll all be fine, you'll see.
Accepting his hand for balance, she exited the car. By the open door, she paused with great deliberateness and filled her lungs with air.
Now that's a wonderful smell, she said. What is that?
Cut the lawn just now. I suspect that's it.
Of course. Now I remember.
She smiled with satisfaction.
How long has it been since I smelled new mown grass?
Smelled anything, for that matter.
Garden's waiting on you. Lots of good smells there.
He made a circle with his arm. Rachel let him lead the way. The shadows were stretching over the ground. Evening was about to fall. He steered her to the gate, where she came to a stop.
Do you know how you make me feel, Anthony? I've been trying to think how to say it.
How's that?
You make me feel seen. Like I was invisible until you came along. Does that sound crazy?
Probably it does. Not to me, said Carter.
I think I sensed it right away, that morning under the overpass. Do you remember?
A feeling of distance came into her eyes.
It was all so upsetting. Everyone honking and yelling, and you there with your sign. Hungry. Anything will help. God bless you.
I thought, that man means something. He's not just there by accident.
That man's come into my life for a purpose.
Carter opened the latch. They stepped through. She was still clutching his arm, the two of them like a couple walking down the aisle. Her steps were solemn and measured. It was as if each one required a separate act of will.
Now, Anthony, this really is lovely.
They were standing by the pool. The water was perfectly still and very blue. Around them, the yard made an effulgent display of color and life.
Honestly, I can hardly believe my eyes. After all this time, you must have worked so hard.
Wasn't any trouble. I had some help, too.
Rachel looked at him.
Really? Who was that?
Woman I know. Named Amy.
Rachel pondered this.
Now,
she declared, raising a finger to her lips,
I believe I met an Amy not too long ago. I believe I gave her a lift. About so tall, with dark hair?
Carter nodded.
A very sweet girl. And what skin. Absolutely glorious skin.
She smiled suddenly.
And what have we here?
Her eyes had fallen on the cosmos. She separated from him and walked across the lawn to the beds, Carter following.
These are just beautiful, Anthony.
She knelt before the flowers. Carter had planted two shades of pink, the first a deep solid, the second softer with green flares on long tippy stems.
May I, Anthony?
You go on and do as you like. Planted them for you.
She selected one of the deeper pink and pinched off the stem. Holding it between thumb and forefinger, she rotated it slowly, breathing softly through her nose.
Do you know what the name means?
She asked.
Can't say I do.
It's from the Greek. It means balanced universe.
She rocked back onto her heels.
It's funny. I have no idea how I know that.
Probably I learned it in school.
A quiet passed.
Haley loves these.
Rachel was looking at the flower, gazing at it as if it were a talisman or the key to a door she couldn't quite unlock.
That she does, Carter answered.
Always putting them in her hair. Her sisters, too.
Miss Riley. Cute as a bug, that one.
A soft night was coming on between the branches of the trees. Rachel pointed her face to the sky.
I have so many memories, Anthony. Sometimes it's all so hard to sort out.
Things will come to you, he assured her.
I remember the pool,
It was happening. Carter crouched beside her. That morning, how terrible everything was. The air so raw.
She took a long, mournful breath.
I was so sad. So incredibly sad. Like a great black ocean, and there you are, floating in it, drifting. No land anywhere, nothing to want or hope for. It's just you and the water and the darkness, and you know it will always be like that. Forever and ever.
She fell silent, lost in these old, troubled thoughts. The air had cooled, the lights of the city coming on, reflected off the cloud deck, making a pale glow. Then,
that was when I saw you. You were in the yard with Haley. Just,
she shrugged,
showing her something. A toad, maybe? A flower?
You were always doing that, showing her little things to make her happy. She shook her head slowly.
But that was the thing. I knew it was you. I believed it was you. But that wasn't who I saw.
She was staring at the ground, dry-eyed, beyond feeling. It would all pour forth now. The memories, the pain, the horrors of that day.
It was death, Anthony.
Carter waited.
I know that's an old idea. A crazy idea. And you so sweet to me. To all of us. But I saw you standing there with Haley, and I thought, death has come. He's here. He's outside right now with my little girl. It's all a mistake. A horrible mistake. I'm the one he wants. I'm the one who needs to die.
The day was fading, colors draining, the sky releasing the last of its light. She raised her face. Her eyes were beseeching, moist and wide.
That's why I did what I did, Anthony. It wasn't fair. It wasn't right, I know that. There are things that can never be forgiven. But that is why.
Rachel had begun to cry. Carter put his arms around her as she collapsed into his weight. Her skin was warm and sweet-smelling, just a hint of her perfume lingering.
How small she was, and he not a big man in the slightest. She might have been a bird there, just a little bit of a thing cupped in his hand.
The girls were laughing in the house.
Oh, God, I left them,
Rachel sobbed. She was clutching his shirt in her fists.
How could I leave them? My babies. My beautiful baby girls.
Hush now, he said. Time to let go of all the old things. They stayed like that for a time, holding each other. Night had descended in full. The air was still and moist with dew. The little girls were singing. The song was sweet and wordless, like the songs of birds.
They waiting on you,
said Carter. She shook her head against his chest.
I can't face them. I can't.
You be strong, Rachel. Be strong for your babies. She let him slowly draw her to her feet and took his arm, gripping it tightly with both hands just above the elbow. With small steps, Carter led her around the pool toward the back door. The house was dark. Carter had expected it to be this way, but could not say why that should be so. It was simply a part, another part, of the way things were in this place. They stopped before the door. From deep in the house, more laughter and the creaking of springs. The girls were jumping on the beds.
Aren't you going to open it? Rachel asked.
Carter didn't answer. Rachel looked at him closely. Something shifted in her face. She understood
that he would not be going with her.
"Have to be this way," he explained. "You go on now. Tell them hello for me, won't you? Tell them I've been thinking on them. Every day."
She regarded the knob with a deep tentativeness. Inside, the girls were laughing with wild delight.
"Mr. Carter."
"Anthony."
She placed a palm upon his cheek. She was crying again. Come to think of it, Carter was crying a little himself. When she kissed him, he tasted not just the softness of her mouth and the warmth of her breath, but also the saltiness of their tears conjoining. Not a taste of sorrow, strictly speaking, though there was sorrow in it.
"God bless you too, Anthony." And before he knew it, before the feel of her kiss had faded from his lips, the door had opened, and she was gone.
76. 20:30 hours. The light was almost gone, the convoy moving at a creep. They were in a coastal tableland of tangled scrub, the road pocked with potholes in places, in others rippled like a washboard. Chase was driving, his gaze intent as he fought the wheel. Amy was riding in back. Peter radioed Greer, who was driving the tanker at the rear of the column. "How much farther?"
6 miles.
6 miles at 20 miles per hour. Behind them, the sun had been subsumed into a flat horizon, erasing all shadows. "We should see the Channel Bridge soon," Greer added. "The isthmus is just south of there."
"Everyone, we need to push it," Peter said.
They accelerated to 35. Peter swiveled in his seat to make sure the convoy was keeping pace. A gap opened, then narrowed. The cab of the Humvee flared as the first bus in line turned on its headlights.
"How much faster should we go?" Chase asked.
"Keep it there for now."
There was a hard bang as they rocketed through a deep hole.
"Those buses are going to blow apart," Chase said.
A scrim of light appeared ahead. The moon. It lifted swiftly from the eastern horizon, plump and fiery. Simultaneously, the Channel Bridge rose up before them in distant silhouette. A stately, vaguely organic figure with its long scoops of wire slung from tall trestles. Peter took up the radio again.
"Drivers, anybody seeing anything out there?"
"Negative. Negative. Negative."
Through the windscreen of the pilot house, Michael and Lore were watching the dry dock doors. The port side door had opened without complaint. The starboard was the problem. At a 150-degree angle to the dock, the door had stopped cold. They'd been trying to open it the rest of the way for nearly 2 hours.
"I'm out of ideas here," Rand radioed from the key. "I think that's all we're going to get."
"Will we clear it?" Laura asked. The door weighed 40 tons.
Michael didn't know.
"Rand, get down to engineering. I need you there."
"I'm sorry, Michael."
"You did your best. We'll have to manage."
He hung the microphone back on the panel.
Fuck.
The lights on the panel went dead. 28 miles west. The same summer moon had risen over the Chevron Mariner. Its blazing orange light shone down upon the deck. It shimmered over the oily waters of the lagoon like a skin of flame. With a bang like a small explosion, the hatch detonated skyward. It seemed not so much to fly as to leap, soaring into the nighttime sky of its own volition. Up and up it sailed, spinning on its horizontal axis with a whizzing sound. Then, like a man who's lost his train of thought, it appeared to pause in mid-flight. For the thinnest moment, it neither rose nor fell. One might easily have been forgiven for thinking it was charged with some magical power, capable of thwarting gravity. But not so. Down it plunged, into the befouled waters. Then, Carter. He landed on the foredeck with a clang, absorbing the impact through his legs and simultaneously compressing his body to a squat. Hips wide, head erect, one splayed hand touching the deck for balance, like an offensive tackle preparing for the snap. His nostrils flared to taste the air, which was imbued with the freshness of freedom. A breeze licked at his body with a tickling sensation. Sights and sounds bombarded his senses from all directions. He regarded the moon. His vision was such that he could detect the smallest features of its face, the cracks and crevices, craters and canyons, with an almost lurid quality of three dimensions. He felt the moon's roundness, its great rocky weight, as if he were holding it in his arms. Time to be on his way. He ascended to the top of One Allen Center, high above the drowned city. Carter took measure of the buildings, their heights and handholds, the fjord-like gulfs between them. A route materialized in his mind. It had the force, the clarity of a premonition, or something absolutely known. 100 yards to the first rooftop, perhaps another 50 to the second, a long 200 to the third, but with a drop of 50 feet that would expand his reach. He backed to the far edge of the platform. The key was first to create an accumulation of velocity, then to spring at precisely the right moment. He lowered to a runner's crouch. 10 long strides, and he was up. He soared through the moonlit heavens like a comet, a star unlocked. He made the first rooftop with room to spare. He landed, tucked, rolled. He came up running and launched again. He'd been saving up. In the cargo bay of the third vehicle in the convoy, among the other injured, Alicia lay immobilized. Thick rubber cords strapped her to her stretcher at the shoulders, waist, and knees. A fourth lay across her forehead. Her right leg was splinted from ankle to hip. One arm, her right, was pinned across her chest. Various other parts of her were bandaged, stitched, bound. Inside her body, the rapid cellular repair of her kind was underway. But this was an imperfect process, and complicated by the vastness and complexity of her wounds. This was especially true of the wing-like flange of her right hip, which had been pulverized. The viral part of her could accomplish many things, but it could not reassemble a jigsaw puzzle. It might have been said that the only thing keeping Alicia Donadio alive was habit, her predisposition to see things through, just as she had always done. But she no longer had the heart for any of it. As the bone-banging hours passed, that she had failed to die seemed more and more like a punishment, and proof enough of Peter's words. "You traitor. You knew. You killed them. You killed them all." Sarah was sitting on the bench above her. Alicia understood that the woman hated her. She could see it in her eyes, in the way she looked at her, or rather, didn't, as she went about attending to Alicia's injuries, checking the bandages, measuring her temperature and pulse, dribbling the horrible-tasting elixir into her mouth that kept her in a pain-numbed twilight. Alicia wished she could say something to the woman, whose hatred she deserved. "I'm sorry about Kate." Or, "It's all right. I hate myself enough as it is." But this would only make things worse. Better Alicia should accept what was offered and say nothing. Besides, none of this mattered now. Alicia was asleep and dreaming. In this dream, she was in a boat, and all around was water. The seas were calm, covered in mist, without a visible horizon. She was rowing. The creak of the oars in their locks, the swish of water moving under their blades. These were the only sounds. The water was dense, with a slightly viscous texture. Where was she going? Why had the water ceased to terrify her? Because it didn't. Alicia felt perfectly at home. Her back and arms were strong, her strokes compact, nothing wasted. Rowing a boat was something she did not recall ever doing, yet it felt completely natural, as if the knowledge had been inscribed into her muscles for later use. On she rode, her blades elegantly